This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe David Krakauer. He is president of the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's fantastic to be back.
It's just great to have you back. You've been at the University of Wisconsin for the last few years. What were you doing there?
I was building and building up a new research institute called the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. It was a tremendous experience. We had virtual reality, mathematics, stem cell research. We were printing organs, just trying to, in a way, take some of the insights and lessons that I learned while I was at SFI to a university. And faculty from all over the campus came and lived in our institute, and we tried to build an institute without walls. And there were many things that I loved about it and some things I didn't like so much.
When I hear terms like printing organs, I mean, it sounds like an oxymoron. And there's a lot of things like that that we don't hold together in our minds.
Yeah.
How advanced is that kind of technology?
Well, you know, it's amazing what's happening. I mean, many of the listeners will be familiar with 3D printers, and usually you're printing with either polystyrene or plastics, unless you have a huge amount of money where you can play with metals. But now it's become possible to deposit thin films of tissue onto plates and create three-dimensional structures that resemble, in a very approximate way, what we'd think of as a tissue, or perhaps even an organ. And so we were asking, would there be a way in which we could, in some sense, in a 3D Petri dish, essentially, construct a rudimentary kidney that would be suitable at some point for transplant? Very early days, but really exciting.
Very interesting. Let's talk, because I think it's really important for people who don't know that much about the work of the Santa Fe Institute. And we did talk recently to Jerry Sabloff, who's the outgoing president, and you're coming in now, but about the work of the Institute. And you wrote an article recently, which I think is the first of a series of articles, on the work that the Institute is doing and how it's practical and how it has practical applications in this world. And you wrote about, among other things, a massive blackout and how that is an illustration of a complex system.
Yeah, this is a new series that we're writing with the Christian Science Monitor. Over the course of a year, they asked us to, the faculty of SFI, to contribute articles on complexity. And I kicked it off. And I use these examples of blackouts because, you know, we've all undergone them, and very often the cause, if you like, of the blackout is not a single factor. So you might think, oh, that particular fuse blew, or that individual dropped T on their computer keyboard. But the reality is there's usually a multitude of different factors that converge. And so a tree, for example, will fall on a power line. Those power lines happen to be overstressed because it's a very hot day and everyone has their air conditioner on, and there's some software that doesn't know what to do when several power lines go down at the same time, and so forth. And to understand those kinds of failures means integrating across those different areas of expertise. And unfortunately, we live in a world where those areas experts seldom speak to one another. And so as a practical example of a very transdisciplinary complexity approach, a very practical problem that has immediate impact on all of us because we don't get to watch Mad Men or Lost on television, it illustrates the importance of bringing together experts to solve problems that we all are confronted with daily.
That question of bringing together people from different disciplines to talk to each other, you'd think that that is really how the world goes around. Because, for example, to run a country, to run a government, even to run a company, a large company, you've got a lot of different factors going on.
Yeah, I mean, we think of that as self-evident at SFI. It's one of the beauties of the Santa Fe Institute, because I think the way that it approaches problems in the world reflects the structure of the world. But for various historical reasons, that's not how universities, for example, or research institutes have been structured, that are very departmental or disciplinary. And so knowledge has been fractured And I think there was a time when that was permissible. Right? Perhaps problems did modularize, right? Perhaps you could solve an important problem by just worrying about the economics or just the engineering. But we're no longer in that world. We're in a world where all of these sectors interconnect. And for example, to have a real impact on energy policy or an impact on the environment, you can't simply talk about the science. You have to be aware of the incredible machinations of the political process. You have to be aware of the public's preconceptions and beliefs. So again, you know, I think you're right. The structure of the problems suggests a form of solution that SFI is really well designed to provide.
In my job here as radio host and talking to you and talking to various people at the Santa Fe Institute over the years and trying to really understand what this idea means, complexity, complex systems, one of the things that has begun clear to me, and anything I say, correct me if I'm wrong, that something like even a really complicated machine like a car or like a rocket ship that we build is not a complex system, and that in fact it is the O-rings that caused the problem, or it, you know, you can basically use that reductionist approach to figure out what the problem is, to figure out how to make things work. But anything that is essentially, I mean, life seems to be the factor that makes a system complex because it's continually adapting and changing. So life versus mechanistic, is that the distinction we're looking at?
Yeah, it's very difficult. And so my, if you were to ask me in one sentence what SFI does as of this week, I would say SFI searches for order in the chaos of an evolving world. That's what we're trying to do. And I think you're absolutely right that the abiotic world, the non-living world, is the world in which we've made incredible progress, right? I mean, it's amazing what we know about the sun or about galaxies that we've never visited, right? Or about the subatomic world of the atom. But when it comes to our neighbors, right, or the society, the political system, the brain, human behavior, crowds, we're somewhat at sea. The way I like to put this is, you know, that we've made amazing breakthroughs in understanding worlds that we'll never feel, stars, you know, things that we'll never feel, the Higgs field, you know, we'll never see, the quark or the pentaquark. But when it comes to the world that we experience physically and emotionally and psychologically, they remain extraordinarily opaque. Newton made that remark, and it's in that article that you allude to. He said, you know, I've understood the motions of the celestial bodies, but I have not been able to understand the madness of the multitude. And what Newton was saying at the time was, I don't understand complexity.
Yeah. And maybe a very prosaic way to say a similar thing is, I can fix my car, but I can't fix my dysfunctional family.
Exactly. And, you know, and I think it's right. I think that the hubris, if you like, the ambition of SFI, and this is something that we could debate, is that it believes that we can make comparable progress in understanding the unifying principles of the family, say, or of society, in the way that we have historically made progress in physics and cell biology.
So let's talk about some examples of progress actually made so far.
So I think there are specific areas that SFI works in that touch on practical reality, and then there are larger ambitions that SFI has, and I want to sort of talk about them both because they're both intriguing. So, I mean, the work that's recently generated a huge amount of interest, I think rightly, is the work on cities. The majority of the world now lives in cities. What is a city? Why is Santa Fe like New York City? Is it really? Are these just aggregations of people, or is there something else going on? And I think what we've begun to realize is that cities have a heartbeat. Cities have a circulatory system. Right? Cities have a nervous system. They're different, of course, but they have signatures, characteristic signatures, that are revealed in their scaling properties. And this is the work of Luis and Jeffrey and collaborators at SFI. And so this is theoretical work that tries to explain, for example, predict the level of intellectual property production as a function of the number of people living in the same city, but also the levels of crime and how you might most effectively intervene. And it's an interesting problem because, and this is one of the wonderful things about complexity science, if you look at physics, you could understand a black hole, right? And you say, wow, in so many millions or billions of years, our galaxy will be consumed by a black hole. And that might be a reality, and it's a fascinating one, but it doesn't really have much implication for policy. it might in many years' time, but certainly not today. Whereas complexity that is in some sense equally arcane, what is a city, you know? How are the cities of today, Paris, similar to the ancient cities of Palenque? But our discoveries have immediate policy implications, and that's what's so odd, that deep theory in complexity often touches practical reality.
So when you talk about that, an example would be just what you said. What are the predictors of crime? What can be done to reduce crime? And I think, as an aside, one thing that's really interesting to me is you can talk about what are the predictors of crime, what could be done to reduce crime, but you can't talk about whether any one person is going to be a criminal. Predicting on a very specific level is nearly impossible. Predicting on a kind of larger scale seems easier.
That's absolutely right. In fact, it's interesting you mention that because it's a perfect segue, because one of the other areas that we have been long interested in is the limits of prediction. What can we predict? What can we not predict? What could we never predict, even if we knew everything, right? And so here's an example. Gets to your point. One way in which we don't know about the future is through chaos. A totally deterministic system. You know everything about its physics, and yet you still can't predict, because some tiny difference in the initial conditions, the so-called butterfly effect, disables us from ever predicting, because we don't have perfect measurement, absolutely perfect measurement, that would cost infinite dollars, essentially. There's another kind of limit to prediction in disease, because these are, as you've pointed out, adaptive agents, evolving agents. Even if you had all the mathematics worked out, a little virus will mutate in a way that you could not have anticipated, and all of a sudden it generates resistance to your best available therapy. That's another kind of prediction, quite different. A third kind of prediction is just the limits of measurement and cognitive power. Now, even if everything was known in principle, you, as an individual, with your computer, don't have access to all the computing resources in the universe, and that'll prevent prediction. So there's some very interesting issues. And the other point that you raise, which is perhaps the most fundamental, is what's known as statistical prediction, which is that while I won't know what any given particle in the room is doing, I'll know what the bulk average of those particles is doing. And we talk about that in terms of things like temperature or pressure, where we forego knowledge of the specific individual, but understand the behavior of the average.
And so when you have the example of the city and the example of crime, mm-hmm. what are some examples of policy implications of this work with respect to crime and prevention?
Well, let's take two examples. Let's imagine, and these are hypothetical, that it was almost inevitable that cities at a certain scale would generate a certain level of crime. Let's say that was inevitable, more or less, statistically.
And why is that?
Well, because of the basic idea, essentially, is that human interactions scale non-linearly in the number of individuals in the city. So think about it this way. If there are three individuals, there are a possibility of around 3 squared interactions, 9. If there are 4 individuals, there's a possibility of 4 squared interactions, about 16. And that increases exponentially as you increase the numbers. So all the interactions start increasing much more quickly than the number of individuals in the city. And that's the basic intuition. And interaction is the key to creativity, collaboration, but is also the key to things like crime. And so it would be a policy decision, I think, as to whether or not you decided, look, the city has grown incredibly quickly. We're producing more inventions than anyone else, but we're also the most unpleasant place to live, right? And so it's not really for a place like SFI to determine or decide, but rather to provide the data that a policymaker might use. And so I think we will be having conversations in the near future about the optimal size of cities.
It's interesting, because what I thought you were going to say is that cities, for whatever reason, inevitably produced more wealth and therefore more inequality, and that inequality produces more crime, or that cities inevitably grow and that means that there's lots of people who don't know each other and you're more likely to steal from somebody you don't know than somebody you do, things like that. Those aren't really exactly math. Well, they kind of are.
Well, they are. Well, interestingly enough, in a way, you know more people in the city, right? You might not know them as well, because the time you have to spend with any of your friends is diminished. So you actually might know more people. But your point about inequalities raises another really fascinating issue, because as you might know, SFI has worked for a long time on issues of inequality, Sam Bowles and his collaborators. Yeah. And that's a very interesting dynamic that's very hot now because of Piketty's book Capital. And so that's intriguing. Is inequality inevitable? I think most of us believe the answer is no. There are certain policies that will increase inequality as the population grows, but others that might diminish it. And so I know Sam, for example, is very interested in the idea of peer-to-peer networks. For example, a very popular version would be Bitcoin, where essentially you're cutting out the middlemen, right? And trades are going on directly between pairs. eBay, for example, would be another that might in fact diminish inequality. So I think it's the combination of the size and the particular institutional structures that lead to inequality or to its reduction.
And then you've got questions that arise when you talk about that from history, where you've got, what, a quarter of a million years of hunter-gatherer societies that had radical equality.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult to say, right? Because I often wonder, and I'm not an expert in this field, I have colleagues who are, but there are different forms of inequality. And you could imagine economic equality, but considerable hierarchy and power. And that's another issue, right? And it might be that we move into a world where we have incredible egalitarian policies with regard, for example, marriage, gay marriage, attitudes towards transgendered populations.
Public schools,
access to knowledge that's free, like Wikipedia, and all of these wonderful things, but somehow combined with an extraordinary disparity of economic income. And I think living in a world where these both very negative and very positive elements coexist is going to be perhaps one of the unique characteristics of the 21st century.
We're talking to David Krakauer, president of the Santa Fe Institute. One of the places where complexity science is really very well studied is evolution. And when you talk about evolution, I mean, you talk about life emerging, all this complex life emerging from single-celled organisms in a way that is utterly unpredictable. I mean, even if we'd been there to witness little bacteria or amoebas or whatever they were floating around, we could have never predicted cockatiels or wolves or humans or anything else. And I wonder how widespread complexity theory is in other places outside of the Santa Fe Institute that are studying biology and evolutionary theory.
Yeah, so, okay, there's several issues in there. And I think I should talk, I'm going to get there, but I want to explain a little bit, having now come back from an extraordinary university and worked on an amazing project, why I think SFI is different. And, you know, the first thing you realize when you go to universities, of course, is departments and schools and chairs and deans and provosts and associate provosts and assistant provosts and this proliferation of titles and divisions and categories. And SFI has none of that, none of it. The other point is, of course, is, you know, you ask yourself, what's the mission of a university or a department? And it's quite difficult to answer that, right? I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, what is the mission of Yale? I don't know, to educate people of means, to conduct extraordinary research in a multitude of areas. Whereas SFI is very different. I mean, SFI has this mission to seek synthesis in complex systems, or as I pointed out earlier, to search for order in the chaos of the evolving world. And so that's very different. The other point about SFI is it's a network, and people forget that. We live in a small state, sparsely populated state, extraordinarily creative one, in a small town. It's not New York City. Why do we have an institute that's better than any other institute in the world, I would claim, as research? And I think the network has a lot to do with it, that our faculty, we have a small resident faculty, we have a large external faculty distributed at universities all over the world. They come to Santa Fe. We have a science board distributed all over the world. And Santa Fe just happens to be the sort of physical space where we, for different periods of time, coexist. And that's an incredibly fluid structure. And the particular amoebic configuration that network conforms to depends on the problems that they're working on. And that makes us very adaptive, like a microbe. I've often thought that, you know, university departments are like multicellular organisms, and SFI is like a bacterial population, right? And so it's very adaptable. So that's one thing. Now it gets to your issue of complexity, because while it's true that people have recognized that there is this space of phenomena that's adaptive and evolving, like culture, like individual humans as they learn and so forth, and that it's worth bringing together a multitude of different individuals to work on them, they don't have two things that we have. The first is that amorphous, distributed network of researchers who come together to work on problems as they present themselves, right? And the other is this hubris that we have, this ambition, which is to find fundamental unifying theories. That's still considered a little bit risque, right, in academic life. It's very ambitious. So I think that while we've been very successful, I think, in generating a diaspora of researchers interested in complexity, nothing really has replicated the uniqueness of SFI.
Do you feel like these ideas that you guys are working on are being taught and proliferated in, for example, the institutions of the external faculty?
To some extent, but it's worth bearing in mind that the external faculty come to us because they're often not satisfied by their home departments. There's something missing. And I was saying to someone this morning, Ed Wilson wrote a rather nice book called Consilience. And consilience, the idea behind consilience is an Enlightenment conceit that says that we could bring different forms of knowledge together, the humanities, mathematics, the natural sciences, the social sciences. And if you pick up the Chronicle of Higher Ed or the Times Literary Supplement or the New York Times, you'll see numerous articles on how the universities, how our knowledge institutions, our libraries are fragmented. The humanists are embattled, they're not appreciated. The money's all going to biomedical research. SFI solved, in some measure, the consilience problem when it was founded. Our earliest programs were collaborations between humanists, computer scientists, economists, and physicists. The Artificial Anasazi Project, which was a very local project, trying to understand the extraordinary civilizations of the Southwest, was an instantaneous collaboration between those individuals, between humanists and scientists. And I think SFI has always done it. And in that sense, no department that I'm aware of, by definition, has even come close.
Do you see analogies between complexity science and literature or the arts? Or in other words, do you see examples of the ideas that you're working on here at SFI expressing themselves in other media that aren't directly involved with the Institute or indeed with science?
Well, absolutely. It's interesting. I mean, there's different ways of thinking about this, right? So at the most modest level, it simply says, I'm a curious mind, and I will use any medium, any tool, any idea, and any person I can possibly get my hands on to solve or address the problem I care about. And in that sense, you're a sort of proto-complexity scientist. Okay? At another level, and in that sense, I would say all artists engage in that activity, sort of ruthlessly pursue the material and the means required to realize their vision. But there's a more direct example where the science that we do in some sense infuses literature and art, and where art infuses the science, is a collaboration between two of my friends, plus two new friends, Cormac McCarthy, the novelist, James Drake, the artist, Cormac's son, John McCarthy, and Caitlin McShay, a young artist in town, discussing the intersection of literature, music, art, mathematics, physics, and computer science. And it's been the most fun I've had in ages. And partly because I just love these people, and they're just so smart and creative, and it's wonderful to be working with them. But it's also because it's an experiment. We had really no idea where this was going to go. But what I was struck by is, looking, for example, at the work of Cormac McCarthy, many people are familiar with his wonderful novels, and I call this Cormac 3.0. The first phase in his career was really the Appalachian novels, Suttree and so forth. Then he moved into the Southwest with Labyrinthian and The Crossing. And people have often asked me over the years, you know, how is the maths and physics of SFI finding its way into the work of Cormac McCarthy? Now, the new book is Cormac 3.0, all mathematics and physics. The protagonist is a female. She's a mathematical genius. The entire book is about maths. Maths and madness and beauty. Now, you look at James Drake.
Hang on a second, but I need to ask you, how is the work of Cormac McCarthy infusing itself in the SFI?
Very good, very good. So in two different ways, I say. One thing that will absolutely shock, and this is a revelation, I guess, many of your listeners, is that Cormac McCarthy is probably one of the most prolific editors of popular science books today. Listeners will have heard of Larry Krauss, for example. The number of physicists, mathematicians, Seth Lloyd, have given Cormac their books to determine whether the narrative structure is coherent, whether the argument is comprehensible, whether they reach certain aesthetic standards. So he's become an extraordinary mentor to a number of scientists who have a desire to reach out to the public through books. That's one. Another one is as an active member of the community, an intellectual centerpiece at SFI, around whom many young faculty crowd. He just represents in his curiosity, his style of mind, his experience, a rather unique element. And the fact that he's willing to draw analogies, that he's willing to span the mathematics and literature in a way that many of us are very cautious not to. So that's more diffuse, but SFI is a culture as much as it is a research institute, and I think he exemplifies that culture.
There's another piece, too, and that is when scientists read his work, maybe that the way that he thinks and the way he takes into account all kinds of disparate elements about what makes society go awry, what makes things work. I mean, I've read some of his books. I don't know his work well enough to comment on that or make an analogy myself, but I was thinking about, with respect to what you're talking about, my very favorite TV show of all time, which is called The Wire, mm-hmm. which is about Baltimore. Baltimore is a complex system. It's a complex system with a very high murder rate. And you look at these five seasons which examine the drug-selling culture, the union dock workers, the city, the educational system, and the newspaper, and how all of those things interact with each other in an incredibly complex way. If I were a complexity science, I'd watch that thing three times.
You're not alone. it's funny you say this. Many people have commented to me about The Wire. In fact, my family live in Baltimore. I think you're absolutely right. The metaphor that I would use is Freudian. It's the latent versus manifest content, complexity content. And I think The Wire, different forms of literature, different arts, have latent content that's all about complexity, as you say. And I think there's no doubt that in his work and the work of many other writers, foremost amongst them Thomas Pynchon or Don DeLillo and others, there is this obsession with the kind of subterranean, unconscious, complex structures. But what's interesting about the recent work is it's become manifest content. It's right there on the surface. It's about what it means to be a creative mind, aesthetically addressing mathematical problems of the most profound variety. And so I think it's worth making that distinction, but in not all cases does that transition take place.
Well, what works of art or literature or whatever have you yourself been influenced by in a deep way that maybe does affect your own science?
Well, that's a hard one. So it's sort of my hobbyist side, my own private life versus my collaborations with artists. And I wanted to mention James in that respect. I am a huge fan of Melville. Moby Dick is a kind of iconic work for me. I think it is one of the most extraordinary ontological experiments in human history. It explores almost all of the concepts that I find interesting: evolution, complex human society, the limits of existence, our relationship to the natural and unnatural world, the quest, in the deepest possible sense, what it means to be alive, and what it means to strive for something that's indefinable. And then, of course, you probably know me, I read sort of everything. I read science fiction, I read poetry, I read fiction, and I spend my entire life reading. In fact, Murray once described reading as a disease. It consumes so much of my time. How it translates into work, I was saying this morning to somebody, you see, fiction has a freedom that non-fiction and science does not have, or art has a freedom. And that is, it doesn't have to be constrained by the evidence, by reality, in the same way that we have to. And that liberates the imagination. And that means that you get to explore the frontiers and boundaries in a way that is extremely difficult for us, even at SFI. Right?
Yeah.
And the best somehow manages to both be extremely brave in the territories that it explores, but also find ways of connecting it directly to our own lives.
And there is potentially a kind of deep truth-telling there.
I think it is.
Even if you're not constrained, as you say, constrained by evidence.
I think you're constrained by the logic, by the aesthetics, by the requirements of the form itself, by your respect for the history of your field. You know, it's interesting. I wanted to bring up James here because most recently he's a visual artist I've been working with, an extraordinary artist who's dedicated his life to drawing. And we discuss this often. What does it mean to make a novel contribution in art when you're living after Picasso and Velázquez and Delacroix? And, you know, shouldn't you just put your brushes down and, you know, go fishing?
And you're living in a very, very image-saturated world in the first place.
Absolutely. And I think this is very challenging. I think that it's, in fact, in that sense, much harder to be an artist than it is to be a scientist, because there's so much that's scientifically unknown. So you can make tiny discoveries that have huge implications. So that's a conversation we've had a lot, and I think it's what's the essence of respecting what came before you, the sort of anxiety of influence, but at the same time striking it out on your own. There are very significant similarities between the science and arts, but I think the art really gets to permute reality. You get to combine elements of reality and explore things that hitherto have not existed, explore sentiments that we've never seen before. And I think the artists that do that well somehow remain true to the possibilities. And the artists that don't do it so well are completely unconstrained. There's somehow got to be a balance, right, between the unique freedom of the form, but also somehow the constraints that keep you honest, that ensure that what you say will connect.
One thing I wanted to talk to you about was education. And 6 years ago, I was in Bali, and in Ubud, Bali, and one of the things that I saw just kind of in the course of walking around was a school where they were teaching what looked like a class full of seven-year-olds how to play gamelan. And these kids were playing these incredibly complex rhythms, and these teachers were pointing around, and you could not even imagine a group of American seven-year-olds engaging that level of musical complexity. And when I realized watching those young people who were just doing it, they were doing it, was that when they grow up, they will be adults with a kind of neural musical ability and ability to understand and hear in a way that I don't have, that I will never have, that we Americans, you know, we sort of European types will never have. So thinking about, I mean, you're talking about complexity in science. If we have a kind of educational system that in scientific terms teaches a very mechanistic, perhaps a reductionist way of thinking about science, like, what would you do if you were teaching a group of fifth graders?
Yeah, I know, it's a really hard question. I view that as the sort of final frontier, you know, the understanding. Maybe the better way to put it is learning, right? I mean, rather than emphasizing the education, which is very the transmitted form, the telegraphic from us to them, the learning angle, which is what is it that individuals absorb and want to understand? And it sounds to me as if the gamelan school has somehow cracked the problem of the fun issue, the participatory element, the collaborative, the playful experimental element. Education so often feels like a set of strictures, that a list of things to know, rather than a world to discover. And I think, you know, it's interesting, having been at the university, I think that educational researchers are hip to that. And there's the flipped classroom. We're now all playing.
What's a flipped classroom?
Well, the flipped classroom is very interesting. Instead of saying, you're going to come to this lecture, and after the lecture I'll set you this homework assignment, and then you'll come in and I'll give you a grade, you do the homework before the lecture. And the lecture is a conversation. And it's kind of interesting to see these things when you have 500 people in the lecture hall, right? It's much more interesting because what it does is it says, there's really no reason for you to hear a lecture with 500 other people. You could do that really alone, drinking a cup of tea without disturbance.
And a lot of us fell asleep during those lectures.
And most of us fell asleep, or in my case, didn't go, right? or you say, well, wait a minute, this is a bit of a party. There are 500 minds here. How could I interact with them in creative ways? And that is being explored. And there's beautiful experiments, in fact, that Carl Wieman has been doing. In fact, this is a curious case of a physicist. He won a Nobel Prize. And he looked at his own career and said, you know, that education experience was pretty lousy. Couldn't I use some of my smarts and reinvent the classroom? And he's been trying. And this flipped classroom is one example, where you have the kids, you know, halfway through the discussion, turn to their neighbors and have a debate, decide whether they believe what they've heard or not, and then ask questions based on those conversations, and combining that in interesting ways with technology. And one of the challenges here is scale. The Gamelan class, I'm guessing, was probably 20 to 30 kids or less.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have to educate a big population. And so what happens when you've got 600? It might not have worked. And I think that's an area where SFI can make a contribution.
I mean, the layman's answer to that is flip the education budget with the military budget and have more teachers and smaller classrooms.
Yeah, that is, as you know, beyond my ability to reckon. That's a complex system of human values and human fears and desires that are... We're absolutely there in the realm of Newton's madness of the multitude. But, you know, in the since I think that's unlikely to happen very soon, we can do experiments. We could take that big group of individuals and say, look, we're going to break you down into smaller groups, and you don't have to sit there and rapt or deadly bored or sleeping, and shake things up a bit. What I've often said to people is the great paradox or irony of research universities is they're constantly doing experiments, constantly, and they're throwing things out because they fail. But when it comes to the university itself, we're still beholden to a model that came out of Prussia in the 1890s.
Right, right.
We should all be wearing monocles. And I think that we need to do experiments in the classroom, and what you were describing is just in the Gamelan School is that.
Were you doing some of that at the University of Wisconsin?
I was.
What did it look like?
Well, I think it was fantastic. I mean,
give us examples.
I'll give you an example. So here's one of the things that I'm most proud of is I built up with a collaborator, and I'll tell you who she is in a second because she's a fantastic, something called the Image Lab. And so when I was at UW-Madison, I had lines, and for your listeners, a line means an FTE that's tenured.
What's an FTE?
Oh, it's basically a full-time position, a full-time employee.
Okay.
And so you can hire, you know, faculty, tenured faculty. And I was at a research institute, but I wanted to achieve some consilience. And I had met the most fantastic person in the world, and her name's Linda Barry, and she is an absolutely extraordinary cartoonist and writer.
She's a great cartoonist.
Right, I mean, anyway, as you know, and I'm sure many...
And the book, ladies and gentlemen, this is just totally an aside, but the book about the decline and death of her parents is one of the most profound things I've read in a long time.
Right, I mean, we're fans, right? And I met her and sat down with Linda for 5-10 minutes, and I thought, you have to be on our faculty. And so I hired her as the first professor of interdisciplinary creativity. She calls herself Professor Long Title, right? And she opened a cartooning lab. And it was just tremendous. What was that? So she would come into work in the mornings and put on a white coat. And we'd have classes that had kids from high schools through to faculty, through to members of the community. So there was no demographic segregation, which is one of the things I can't stand. And they'd sit in there, and essentially she's very much the disciplinarian. It's interesting. She'd sit down and she would say, look, you are all going to visualize the following, you know, car and a roundabout, what have you. And cartoon it. I don't care whether you can draw well or badly. I want to get a sense of how you start representing the world. It's sort of, if you like, habits of thought, habits of drawing. And the thing that Linda always points out that I thought was very intriguing is the following. When you start as a child drawing, you're basically experimenting. Right? If there's a crayon on a table at a restaurant and your parents are boring you to death, you just start scribbling. You don't care whether it looks good or bad. You're experimenting. And as we age, we become more and more reluctant to draw because we think someone's looking over our shoulder and saying, you draw like a four-year-old, right? Which I do, by the way. And her point was, what happens to us that we go from being experimentalists in our youth to completely risk-averse in later life? And I was interested in that for science. I thought, you know, you've hit on something, and you have a series of processes for ameliorating it that we need in terms of another domain of exploration. And that was probably my favorite example of an experimental lab that was taking ideas from cartooning and diffusing them into the research culture.
So you, as a scientist, were talking to David Krakauer, president of the Santa Fe Institute, have, for whatever reason, been able to kind of maintain that, I think, childlike, exploratory, risk-taking way of living. What do you think has allowed you to do that?
Ooh, that's a hard question. Well, part of it is, I don't know, temperament in part. I mean, it's a disposition. It's something I don't know, some complex combination of factors. I've never liked authority very much. It's sort of weird being in this position or having had these positions of authority because I can't stand it. And FFIs are wonderful because it's sort of self-organizing structure. And I'm part evangelist, part visionary, part cheerleader, I guess. And I don't have to be despotic, and I couldn't be. So that playful element, that play is the ultimate means of subverting a system, that a certain kind of constructive disrespect, right? Skepticism and doubt. I don't think you can be a good researcher without being irreverent. Because if you think about it, the game we're playing is to challenge the orthodoxy. To say, you know, Newton, what on earth was he talking about? It's completely wrong, right? Or Einstein or Darwin, all these incredible, you know, or Emmy Noether, or just extraordinarily creative Marie Curie. So I think it's sort of built in or baked in to the logic of the enterprise, but for some reason, and that's what Linda was getting at, we're traumatized, we're discouraged, and we're confined by the systems that we build. And one of the charms of SFI is that it recognizes that and works incredibly hard to ensure that those kinds of confinements, those boundaries, don't get constructed.
I like the term constructive disrespect and irreverence, and kind of relate to them myself, I suppose, in a lot of ways. But one of the things that is absolutely necessary for those things to really grow and develop and become something beautiful and creative is safety. So if you have irreverence and constructive disrespect and you're living in the time of the Inquisition, you're toast. And if you are in, say, a department or whatever that has a kind of orthodoxy, and we see orthodoxy in all kinds of systems that don't bill themselves as being orthodoxy. For example, I mean, in certain kinds of, like, super leftist, you know, social change ways of thinking, if you stray out of that, you're the bad guy.
Yeah. It's really an important point. It's funny you talk about this. I'm obsessed with this at the moment, which is radicalism and risk and these related concepts such as security and safety. You know, great climbers have great safety harnesses.
Right.
And skydivers have great parachutes. Right. They're doing risky things, but they know that they've done their due diligence with respect to their backups. And I think, you know, when I went to Madison, it's interesting you say this, trying to build up an institute, I asked people for metaphors for what it might be. And so what did I get? I get the really obvious ones. It's a catalyst, they'd say. And I said, but you know, I'm not an enzyme. You know, people would say, it's a blender. And I said, well, I don't want to live in a blender because you see what happens to the fruit when you put them in. I don't want to be a smoothie. You know, where you're an incubator. And I thought, well, that's a bit closer, but it also has this notion that you're taking something that couldn't survive. And so I started playing with the idea of a greenhouse. And it's an organic metaphor, but what it gets at is this idea that why do we have greenhouses? Because we live in inhospitable environments, but there are species that we would like to cultivate that couldn't survive in those inhospitable environments. But we can grow them in the greenhouse because they're safe, they get the nutrients that they need, and they can flourish. And once they have, maybe we can take them out of the greenhouse and put them back into the environment. And that's what I like to think of in terms of your remark about risk. You have to build the environment that allows for the exotic species to prosper. And given enough time, they develop that resilience that will allow them to survive in the world. But they'll never grow if you put them in the world right at the beginning. I think that's right.
Right, right. And do you see Santa Fe Institute as that?
I absolutely do. I think that the intellectual landscape is hostile. You know, it's very difficult if you have a new idea and you say, you know, I've discovered this new theory for the origin of life, or, you know, a city is an organism, or the ecosystem of the Precambrian period is like the contemporary environment. These are outrageously ambitious remarks that people are making, and SFI has to be the home that makes them feel safe.
You know, it's interesting because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems like not all science is Newton and Einstein. I mean, Newton does his thing, and then gazillions of unremembered university graduates with PhD develop those ideas to the point where the next breakthrough can happen.
Yeah. It's a very, again, you know, this is absolutely a very common foundational discussion in the arts, too, right? I mean, is it really all single artists of great genius, or is it not? Is it studios?
That's the exact same thing.
Ateliers. And I think, and yeah, this is a very interesting conversation. It's one that we should be having. You know, I'm torn. And let me tell you why. On the one hand, yes, the collaborative draft, you know, the incremental contributions of large numbers of individuals who live in the shadows, and that a single individual, it's a bit like economic inequality, right, that certain individuals get all the prizes. And there's some truth to that, there's no doubt. On the other hand, I think about the negative side of that, the committee, right, that it's very difficult to make a decision by committee, and if you want to do something truly creative, you sort of have to break through free of the confines, first of your family, and then of your friends, and then of society. And so I oscillate back and forth between, on the one hand, thinking, yes, it really is groups, and the cult of the hero is an anachronism from the Victorian period, to, you know, no, because it's almost impossible to do something new when you've got everyone clamoring around telling you what you should be thinking.
Right, right. But I mean, you know, let's say somebody invents a vaccine, then you've got teams of scientists for generations improving on that initial idea, doing a wonderful job, making a good salary, having a pension, having nice family lives. I mean, there's nothing wrong with
it. Not
that
at all. You know, I it's funny you say that. I one of the big debates that's come up recently in relation to institutes like SFI and others is, what is the ideal environment for creative life? And, you know, I'm a sort of student of those kinds of institutions now, and I try to understand. And what I've heard, I go to one talk after another, they say, well, it needs to be this, or it needs to be that. And what you realize is that it can't be any one thing. And my metaphor now is mountains, monasteries, and the metropolis. There is a time when you want to be out in the mountain. You want to do the Rousseau thing. When you're out on your own and you're seeking inspiration, and you're connecting with the world around you without the encumbrances of other human beings. But then you want to take that back to the monastery, to your society of friends with whom you feel safe, where you can have a discussion and debate, you can receive criticism, and you can make improvements. And when you feel safe that you have something, you take it to the metropolis, where
Yes.
you sell your wares.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
All of those environments are completely different. And, you know, I think SFI is the monastery.
Yeah, exactly. David Krakauer is president of the Santa Fe Institute. You can find the Santa Fe Institute on the web at santafe.edu. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was a pleasure. It's wonderful to talk to you again.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to Studio X for their technical support and web design.